So this is some work that I've done with Pavel Mazur. I understand Pavel was here a few months ago, so if he gave a completely lucid lecture, then I apologize for repeating the same things. But
lots of the audience is different than yesterday.
Okay. focus. Okay, so what I'm going to do is, what I really would like to do is tell you about a new solution to Einstein's equations with sources, whose purpose was basically motivated to understand how to make black hole physics, as we know it from classical general relativity, also consistent with quantum mechanics. So just to give away my punchline, the main features of this new configuration are that it has no singularities, either at the origin or at the event horizon. In fact, has no event horizon, and is consistent with quantum mechanics, unitary evolution. There's no information paradox, and moreover, it maximizes the entropy functional, so it's stable. So I'll review a couple of things here before getting to the solution and trying to motivate it so it doesn't look like it's completely out of the blue, just to show you what we're thinking about. You know, sometimes when you talk to astronomers, they tell us what, you know, well, we already know there are black holes. So I always like to show some pretty picture like this where there's some astronomical evidence, which you can read about here, about the possible astrophysical existence of a black hole. But I always find it amusing that just under the evidence is a drawing credit. So that, I mean, the real point, of course, the serious point, is that all the astrophysical candidates are in very complicated environments, typically, and one has accretion disk, rotation, a lot of complicated stuff going on. And so you're exploring a region near to the would-be or event horizon, but what actually is happening at the event horizon is not easy to pull out from astronomical data. So I thought I would start kind of by, I was talking with Tony Z a couple of weeks ago and mentioned that Einstein and Dirac also had some problems with black holes, so I guess he kind of challenged me to find the references. So I went back and searched, and so there's somebody named Einstein who wrote a paper back in 1939 basically asking whether the Schwarzschild metric, here written in some isotropic coordinates, whether or not it is possible to build up that singular configuration with the help of actual gravitating masses. And he went on to consider a model of trying to build up a self-gravitating object like a black hole out of just ordinary point particles. And in that case, anyway, in his model, he didn't form an event horizon. And here's another fellow who had some problems. This is 1962, and he says that the mathematicians can go beyond the Schwarzschild radius. So of course, this was 2 years after the Kruskal continuation of the Schwarzschild form. And so Dirac knew about that. But I would maintain that this inside region is not physical space, because to send a signal inside and get it out again would take an infinite time. And so he also was a bit worried about this. So that's my appeal to authority. I'll leave it at that, as to why there might be some issues that some people who had, you know, some reputation thought about. So, okay, so let's start at the beginning and go back to the Schwarzschild metric. So for this talk, I'm going to restrict myself completely to spherical symmetry, no angular momentum, charge, or anything like that. Your basic black hole solution, which is spherically symmetric, and of course the solution to the Einstein equations for a static source is just written in this line element like this, with two functions of R only, which are equal in the Schwarzschild case. So what are the important features? Well, first of all, it's asymptotically flat, of course, and becomes Newtonian at large distances. At the origin, however, there are infinite tidal forces. You have a true singularity. The Riemann curvature tensor blows up, and so I think everyone would agree that something has to give before you get there, and classical GR can't be right all the way down to that singularity. Now, at the famous event horizon, or Schwarzschild radius, 2GM, you have a coordinate singularity where these coordinates clearly break down because the function f and h both vanish. This corresponds physically to infinite blue shift of radiation with respect to an observer at infinity, so that if you sit just outside of the Schwarzschild radius, your local frequency, your clock, is running at a rate which is infinitely blue shifted or red shifted, depending on which way you refer it. Okay, so of course, inside this critical radius, it's a trapped surface, so that inside light cannot get out, and space and time interchange roles. You're inevitably drawn down into the singularity, and of course, that's what makes a black hole black. So there's no doubt that this is a pure, this is the correct solution classically for an isolated mass, and that this is a purely coordinate singularity in the sense that you can certainly go to analytically extended coordinates where this particular problem at r equals 2gm is no longer a singularity. The Riemann curvature, for example, does not blow up there. It's quite small if the mass is large. And so classically, there's no problem except that you have this singularity in the origin and you have this trapped surface where light can't escape from. So all of this, of course, is true in the classical theory, just to make sure we understand each other. Now, the real interesting stuff happens when you start thinking about h-bar, which some people anyway think is different than zero, and what effects that might have. I say that only because I come from Los Alamos, and sometimes they use natural units there, and that consists in putting h-bar equal to zero for a lot. So I often have to convince them that quantum effects actually can be important sometimes, but never mind. So the important thing, of course, and is that frequency, which is purely a kinematic shift, you know, just like a Lorentz transformation shifts space and time, classically, you can always take a wave satisfying a linear wave equation and make its amplitude arbitrarily small, no matter what its frequency is. So classically, you can always neglect the effect of the perturbing energy on the background when h bar is equal to zero. However, quantum mechanically, you can't do that, because a wave carries an energy, an amplitude is fixed basically by uncertainty principle. So the energy is given in terms of the frequency. Hence, you have to worry about whether or not these limits commute. If you put h bar to zero right away, then this is pure kinematics. If h bar is different from zero, even small, then a large frequency, a divergent frequency, becomes a diverging energy, and gravity knows something about energy. So this is a question, I think, that has caused, I mean, there's been a lot of papers. It's impossible to go through and review them here. But so I'm just giving a heuristic argument that basically, if you have a large energy and you have a dimensionful coupling, you do in the Einstein theory, so just like the Fermi theory, at very large energies, the effective coupling grows. So if you have a large energy near the horizon, and this is the right energy to be talking about, then you can have large quantum gravitational effects near the horizon. The horizon is going to fluctuate. Now, the famous result, which we all know about for more than a quarter century, is the semi-classical Hawking result, which says that if you ignore the fluctuations of the horizon and treat everything just on a fixed Schwarzschild background, that same metric we wrote down, then there's the remarkable result that Hawking found, that the black hole with reasonable initial conditions on ingoing waves would actually not be black completely, but would emit massless particles in particular with a thermal spectrum which is inversely proportional to the mass. So that's a very interesting result, as you see, uniting quantum mechanics, statistical mechanics, and gravity. However, it is done in this fixed background calculation, and there are a whole host of problems that come with this calculation and raise very fundamental issues about whether we understand what we're doing here. First of all, just from simple thermodynamics, Hawking himself pointed out, since the temperature is inversely proportional to the mass, therefore inversely proportional to the energy, the specific heat, dE dt, is negative. So if you try to put this black hole with this Hawking flux in equilibrium with its own radiation, you find that that equilibrium is unstable. That's a bit confusing, although, of course, gravity is typically has instabilities coming from unbounded attraction at short distances. Secondly, if you think about applying first law of thermodynamics to this, then you quickly see from T going like 1 over m that you must have an entropy that goes like m squared. And actually, it really is a good exercise to put in some numbers here, because only that really brings out the true stupendous nature of this, that if you put in a mass of the order of the sun, the entropy here is 10 to the 77 in Boltzmann units. Remember, the entropy is the logarithm of the number of states, so the number of states is e to the 10 to the 77. For comparison, you should think about a normal star like the sun, and there the entropy goes linearly with the mass. It's basically the number of nucleons in the star, and so that's a number like 10 to the 57 or 58. So in order to get from a main sequence star like the sun down to a black hole with a similar mass, you have to have something like 20 orders of magnitude in the entropy, or e to the 20, e to the 10 to the 20 number of states somehow have to be generated in the collapse problem. And that's really remarkable. When you look at the formula, it doesn't tell you anything about the collapse process. There's nothing but fundamental constants here and the mass squared. So in particular, if you form the thing adiabatically, you would think you're not creating huge amounts of entropy, and yet it grows by a factor of 10 to the 20. So that's very puzzling. Now, Hawking himself suggested that this would require some rather drastic modifications of quantum mechanics to understand this, because if you just think in terms of unitary evolution, it's very hard to understand where this huge factor would come from. And I'm not going to try to review their local experts here about all of the various attempts that have been made to understand that. There are dozens, if not hundreds, of papers, probably in the many dozens, talking about this in various kinds of models. But needless to say, this is a problem. And of course, the statement that it's non-extensive in many different ways, it doesn't scale just with the mass or the volume of the black hole. It doesn't depend, for example, on the number of species. If I had 10 times as many neutrinos as I have, then they each should be emitted at the same temperature. So you would think that the entropy, the number of states, should be scaling. The entropy should scale like the number of massless species. There's no way that fits into this formula. So
isn't the number of the entropy supposed to be related to the number of ways you could form a black hole of mass m, mm-hmm. right? Rather than say just the entropy of the sun, which is only one way.
Well, the question is, if you started with an object like the sun, and it had just too big a mass, bigger than to form a neutron star, and then collapsed, where would those number of states come from? So you're saying that I should not think of this as the entropy of an object that formed from the sun? I'm not sure I understand.
Entropy depends on the coarse grain.
Yes.
So it depends on what coarse grain. If you're only specifying the number n.
Yes.
And indeed, the string theorists have calculated.
In extremal case, of course.
No, even in the neutral case, there's an argument that a string has enough states to reproduce this formula.
Well,
what we can't calculate is the factor of a quarter, which is four or something in your formula. But to get it scaling like m squared is possible.
Well, I know it's possible. There are models that do it. Not only string models, but other models that do it. So I'm not saying it's impossible, but I'm saying it's you have to work, right? You have to have new degrees of freedom, and it's not obvious how it's consistent with quantum evolution without changing the laws of physics. So string theory is certainly changing the laws of physics outside of this context. Okay, now I've been thinking about it a different way, so we're still in the motivation here, and so I want to get to the solution before we get too late. But there are some salient features that you should think about when you think about this semi-classical calculation in fixed background of Hawking. One is you can calculate the flux of the radiation, or also its energy density and its pressure near the horizon. This is just a one-loop calculation of the renormalized expectation value of a quantum field in the background geometry. And you find that these components of this stress tensor, which are in the orthonormal frame corresponding to an observer sitting fixed near the horizon, these blow up. So in fact, that naive argument about the energy of a single quantum blowing up near the horizon actually gets translated, if you just follow it through, it is exactly that fact that is causing the expectation value of the energy momentum tensor also to diverge there.
Sorry, what, are you assuming that there's a particular vacuum here?
This is in any vacuum in which there is radiation. So in particular in the unruh state, this is true. It is not true in the Hartle-Hawking state.
But that's unstable.
But that's unstable, yeah. So, but in any state in which there is a flux, there is this factor.
So if we take a state, which is we start on a space-like surface with a pre-collapsed star,
yep.
We define the vacuum for some field, we define the vacuum that has no quanta of that field in it.
Yep.
We follow the evolution through, which in principle we could do calculating all those modes.
Yep.
We'll say that this will blow up in that vacuum.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. But of course, again, this is coordinate dependent. It's a frame in which it doesn't get large.
Yeah, this is a tensor quantity, so of course you can change, make coordinate transformations to other. This is an orthonormal frame.
And they're related, like loops. Right,
you can take something in orthonormal frame, exactly. You can boost something in orthonormal frame to get as big as you want.
Sure, and this is infinitely boosted from a freely falling observer.
Right, but I would claim that means, that's like saying that we can take a gauge in which something goes away, but we should be calculating something gauge invariant. So a tensor transforms like a tensor. There's no surprise you can transform it. The question is, what are its effects in some physical gauge invariant sense? And you can just do the following exercise. You can take that diverging energy momentum tensor and use it as a source term. I'm jumping ahead of myself, but if you were to use it as a source term in Einstein's equations and calculate the metric coefficients, then you would find a large curvature effect near the horizon.
Can I just say one thing?
Sure.
I know you want to get on to your...
Yeah, I do, but...
But since this is an important motivation...
Okay.
If you take a general curved space-time, forget a black hole, just any curved space-time, and ask,
yes,
how are you going to measure something physical?
Yes.
Normally, we would say, okay, we start with geodesics,
yes,
because those are the natural motion of freely falling particles, and then along the geodesic, you construct an orthonormal frame, and maybe parallel propagate along the geodesic or something.
Mm-hmm.
But, okay, so in that case, if you say, okay, you compute something along a geodesic, and it's finite, if you were to do an infinite boost, it's not surprising that you get infinite answers. Components get infinitely big, mm-hmm, factors if you infinitely boost away from the geodesic.
Mm-hmm.
So now in the black hole case, the geodesics would give you the finite answer because that's the freely falling, infalling, mm-hmm, guys. And the quantities you're mentioning here are the ones which are infinitely boosted with respect to, quote, the natural,
mm-hmm,
frame. And so that could be understood as why you're getting a big factor.
No, that's true. It's kinematics at the level of the shift, blue shift. Okay, but I insist the real question should be a dynamical one. What are the effects of this in any frame you choose?
Well, let's rephrase my question. When you start with this star, you let it collapse. And now let's just do it in a non-singular set of coordinates, right?
Mm-hmm.
Don't get singular horizon.
Yeah, so you are free to, of course, calculate this in any coordinates you like.
I actually don't know the answer. Do they blow up then?
I believe so, yes, because I have done it. I haven't. Many other people have done it in these coordinates. And well, what's your question again? Sorry. You can use the maximum analytic extension Kruskal coordinates and the capital U, capital V.
Yeah.
and those things, in that frame, as Gary is, I think, referring to, these components do not diverge.
Similarly, if you take trace of t or trace of t squared or trace of t grad t or anything like that,
those scalars don't diverge. However, if you use these sources, mm-hmm. even in those frames, and calculate the Riemann tensor by solving Einstein's equations and then taking the Riemann tensor squared, that thing does diverge.
That's controversial. I don't think that's generally believed.
Okay, you can look at it. I believe
that the back reaction is to change.
No, I don't. I mean, because you should be able to use any coordinates you want to
right.
answer equation.
Exactly.
And so I'm free to use my coordinates with non-singular, if my source doesn't work.
Okay, we're gonna get bogged down here. I'm happy to talk about this, but let me just make a few statements which I believe are true, and if you don't agree, we can talk about it later. One thing you can do is, and this has been done by several people, including more recently Tuft, is to take an equation of state, and that's here already on this slide. Let's take an equation of state, P equals kappa rho. I see kappa is not defined on this slide. P equals kappa rho, and plug it into the Einstein equations. Look at static spherically symmetric solutions with that fluid, with that equation of state. Okay, those differential equations have been solved by matched asymptotic expansions for large m, much bigger than the Planck mass. And in fact, Zurek and Page did in 84, and Tuft rediscovered it. And I assure you that the geometry of that fluid is not the Schwarzschild geometry, not a small perturbation of it. The back reaction of that fluid, if extrapolated all the way down to the event horizon, changes the event horizon and the geometry
so
in a large way.
You're putting in something in this frame, and so you've added the large ingredient. You put in a fluid, which is...
I put in a fluid and look for a static solution.
So static in
right.
this frame.
Great. So that's a statement, okay?
Yeah.
Now, maybe you don't like that equation of state, you don't like that calculation, okay? But...
now you put something large in, so that surprises a large back reaction.
Okay. So the other thing you can think about is the fact that even though you can make a coordinate transformation to the maximally analytic Kruskal coordinates, remember that basically demanding analyticity near the horizon, demanding that nothing is really going on there, is essentially equivalent to saying that you have a smooth Euclidean continuation. So that whenever you have a flux, there is some singular behavior near that point where the two things cross. So near the light cones, where the future and past light cones cross. So it really, I think on general grounds, you should expect, even geometrically, to have some large effects there. But let us grant that the definitive calculation of the back reaction has not been done. Fair? Now, let me mention this as I jump to this point. The Zurich page and then Tuft calculation is actually quite interesting because what he did was take an equation of state, P equals kappa rho, and you were mentioning, Gary, about calculating the entropy and getting a large value. Well, in that model, you can just do ordinary relativistic hydrodynamics. There's an entropy density associated with that equation of state. You integrate that entropy, you find the solution first, and then you integrate that entropy density over the volume, and things fall off as you get outside of R about 2m. But inside R 2m, the fields are very big, and there's a huge entropy coming from the fluid that's compressed into that region. And what Tuft found is that the entropy, just coming from hydrodynamics, no special assumptions, no new degrees of freedom, first of all, is of order of the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy, and is given by a very simple function of kappa, which becomes equal to the Bekenstein-Hawking formula, kappa equals 1. I don't know how generally known that is, but it's a fact.
So, what is this, the entropy, what's the mass?
For any mass. Demand asymptotic boundary condition for any fixed mass as long as it's large compared to the Planck mass.
These stars have a surface area of squares. Does the pressure go to zero on that reading?
No. No, it falls off.
But the mass is finite?
Yeah, what he did actually was normalize the pressure and density to the Hawking radiation at infinity. So in fact, you know, it never goes to zero. It goes to T to the fourth, where T is the Hawking temperature.
How do you do that when it should be P equal
1? Well, you can take any equation of state you want. Say it's a hydrodynamic equation, so, right? You're just solving Einstein equation.
No, I agree with that. But the Hawking, the normalization would be P equal 1.
That's for a massless field. But if you just take, I mean, you're thinking about a field theory, a microscopic model. But I just put in by hand an equation of state with a certain temperature, and that temperature at infinity is the Hawking temperature, can just solve the Einstein equation.
Put in the Hawking temperature.
Yeah. So that's the only information that where Hawking is put in. And then, so there are two points. One is that you do get of order of the mass squared, coming just from hydrodynamics. There's no factor of n here. So, for example, you can easily take, there is a normalization n in the equation of state, where n is the number of species of particles, and it drops out. And you can actually look at the calculation and see why it drops out. It drops out because the entropy density certainly scales like n, but so does, there's a compensating factor in the geometry. You get a squeezing of this stuff, which is going like 1 over n, and it drops out. That's interesting, I think. So there's no species problem in this thing. And there is also this identity of entropies when S equals, when cap equals 1. And that corresponds to an effective one-dimensional fluid if P equals rho. So there's another way of thinking about this. That P equals rho is a critical equation of state, Zeldovich equation of state, where the speed of sound is equal to the speed of light. And so if you are pumping the pressure up due to some kind of quantum effects like this, where the radial components and the time components of the energy momentum tensor are getting large, you could imagine that that's exactly the equation of state that is the right one near to the event horizon. So I'm just trying to give you a motivation through these semi-classical arguments of why the equation of state P equals rho is not unrelated to the correspondence limit of the Hawking entropy. Now, we have some other reasons, which I won't go into here. It turns out I can get P equals rho from a effective action, which is based on the trace anomaly, and just technically having a region of P equals rho is important for what I'm going to show you next. Okay, so maybe I can now, I wanted to say a few remarks about, so that was to basically motivate having an equation of state P equals rho near to the horizon. Now I want to say something else. I want to think about Bose-Einstein condensation first in general and then in context of gravitation. So just some general remarks about Bose-Einstein condensates. Of course, any number of particles can occupy the same single particle state. And it's a very generic feature. At high enough densities or low enough temperatures, the free energy of a gas of bosons is always minimized if you push all of the bosons into the ground state. This tendency to condense takes place in the absence of interactions, as the original calculations, or even with interactions as long as they're not too strongly repulsive. And of course, attractive interactions make it all the more favorable. Another important point is it's macroscopic. So every time you look at a superfluid in the lab, you're looking at quantum mechanics of a macroscopic object. Superfluids, superconductors, and of course, the recent work, beautiful work, which got the Nobel Prize for atomic gases. And, you know, we often don't think about it this way, but in field theory, we are also actually calculating a kind of relativistic condensate when we talk about the vacuum expectation value of a field in spontaneous symmetry breaking. We don't use the same words, but in fact, it can be thought of as a kind of condensation phenomena of the Higgs bosons. Now, why could this be relevant for gravity, and what's the new idea here? Well, gravity is a theory of spin two bosons. Their interactions are attractive. if they become strongly attractive due to this argument about the scaling of the energy near the event horizon, there is nothing, I would say, on general principles to forbid a formation of a new phase, a phase transition, a condensate of space and time itself. Now, we're not going to discuss any microscopic theory of that condensate. I don't know what it is. But if it forms and it has a scalar order parameter, then we already know that it has to couple to the Einstein equations like a cosmological term. Because, well, you know that from inflationary models, basically any space-time homogeneous condensate described by a scalar order parameter enters the energy momentum tensor like a cosmological term. In other words, it has equation of state P equals minus rho. There's a different way to understand that. If you think in terms of relativistic hydrodynamics, the Gibbs relation tells you, if you have no conserved quantum number, no conserved particle number, that the local temperature times the entropy density of any relativistic fluid is equal to P plus rho. So if P equals minus rho, the entropy density is zero. That's exactly what you would expect for a single macroscopic quantum state.
But you were looking for a state with a large entropy, right?
Well, I'm going to tell you in the end, no, I'm not. In some semi-classical limit, yes. But that's the limit in which this condensate is gone from the picture.
You want us to make sure it's the gravitons that are making the condensate?
The gravitons are the low-energy excitations of in the vacuum, in the ordinary phase. So you can think of them as attractively forming some kind of condensate, yes. Although they may not be you may want to talk in terms of completely different degrees of freedom in when you have a phase transition. They are the low energy degrees of freedom, right?
The scalar is just some standing,
Yeah, any scalar. I mean, I don't want to try to give you a theory. I'm trying to motivate the idea. Now, of course, this is relevant for things like singularities and black holes, because if you have this equation of state, you don't satisfy the strong energy condition, and there's no reason actually to have singularities. This was pointed out a long time ago. So it acts, if you did form this condensate, it acts as a kind of repulsive core to the center of a black hole. And therefore, it's an interesting question of whether you can form a stable object with this kind of equation of state, which is a vacuum equation of state, but with a non-zero positive cosmological term, whether you can form a compact, cold object which is stable to further collapse. So that's the motivations. Okay? So, any?
Which sign of cosmological constant?
Positive.
Is there a symmetry that gets broken by this condensate?
That's a good question. It's basically global conformal invariance. Okay, it's like global phase invariance for a Bose-Einstein condensate. If you just make the phase imaginary, then it's like a conformal transformation. So it's similar to that. Okay.
Wouldn't it be charge conservation?
I don't think so.
Some kind of charge.
Now this has to be a gravitational effect, so it has to be built into the metric theory somehow. Okay, so I mean I can give you stuff, but you know, some ideas, but I don't want to at this point. I just want to now, in the last 20 minutes, just describe to you what we actually did. Okay, all of this is just, you know, motivation, talk, background. Okay, so we wrote down these Einstein equations for that line element, remember the original one with two metric functions, f and h, but now there are some non-trivial sources here, okay, which is conserved, so it all fits within the usual Einstein theory, principle of equivalence, everything's fine. And you just write down the equations. The other components, it turns out, are just given in terms of these by differentiating, so you only need to look at three first order ordinary differential equations. But there are four functions, right? F, H, rho, and P. So it becomes a closed system only when you specify some equation of state. and it's just an equation of state here of a fluid, a perfect fluid. However, I'm going to choose, for all the reasons that I've just been going on about, three different equations of state. Well, on the outside, there's no equation of state. It's just a vacuum. So there's some radius, R2, outside of which there's nothing. And then inside this radius, there's another interface region at R1, where the equation of state changes from this condensate of P equals minus rho to this critical interface region where P equals plus rho. That's the model. You just go, follow your nose, and plug in and solve the equations. It's trivial, of course, in both the exterior region and the interior region, because in the exterior region, you just get, again, Schwarzschild, because there's no energy momentum tensor. In the interior region, you, of course, have a patch of the Sitter universe, because it has positive cosmological constant. And there's another integration constant here, C, which is traditionally set equal to 1, but I don't have to set it equal to 1. And in fact, it's needed to do the matching properly. The only non-trivial region, and here's the only technical meat, really, in this paper, is the interface region between, sandwiched between 1 and 3. And here we have this equation of state P equals plus rho. If you look at the conservation equation, that tells you P times the metric function F is a constant. By a simple change of variables, you can write the relevant equations this way. And the amusing thing is that if the shell is thin, so what I have in mind, of course, is that this shell region is occurring right near where the horizon would want to form. So from the outside point of view, as I come in at a critical radius, R equals 2gm, H would vanish. From the inside, going out, as I reach a critical radius of 1 over H naught, H would also vanish. So the idea is to match the two. So here I fall off from a constant quadratically, and I come in from infinity like this. And the idea is to do something here to turn around. Sorry to... Okay.
Is,
yes?
Is rho some fixed number that's determined by...
No. No. This is just any old rho. I mean, because now everything is determined. Because once I give you all these equations of state and do the matching condition, of course, what I'm going to demand is that the metric functions F and H are continuous at these interfaces, although because the equation of state is changing and the equations are first-order equations, necessarily the first derivatives will not be continuous at the, in this way.
Can you talk more about that? Because that's not a trivial point.
It, not completely trivial, right?
It's, I can.
Yeah, sure, I can.
I mean, because you really have to match both functions and their derivatives, or else you have a source there.
There's well, jumping the gun, but there's a tangential pressure there. That's what happens. Okay. All right. So these are the equations. The point is now, if this region where the P equals rho applies is just very close to the would-be horizon, then H is very small there, much less than 1. So these equations can be solved analytically in the leading order approximation, which I neglect H on the right-hand side. Then it becomes a trivial first-order equation.
You can also take a large region, right, as well?
Yeah. I haven't, R1 and R2 are free parameters so far. I haven't told you anything about what fixes them. So I have in mind that this is a critical region near to the would-be horizon because of these stresses building up there. But of course, Einstein's theory doesn't know about that. It has to be told where to put R1 and R2. So if you neglect H, then it's just trivial to integrate the equations. You get definite functions of W, which is this combination of pressure and radius. And there's an integration constant, of course, which I call epsilon, because epsilon will control how big H gets near this region. So if epsilon is much less than 1, then H gets very small, but need not go to zero. In fact, it's strictly positive. The last function is f, and that's given by this. It just goes like 1 over w. And now comes the matching, which you were asking about. I didn't write a slide, but I can, I mean, it's a little bit technical, but I can go through it. So basically, there's two interface regions. I mean, what I've done is I've got a finite interface here, because I'm keeping R1 separate from R2. And I've got a, if you wish, a transition zone or boundary layer at R1 and R2 where the equations of state changes in my approximation anyway discontinuously. So that's indeed the point where you have to match carefully. So the first derivatives are, I mean, the functions are continuous. The first derivatives are discontinuous. The second derivatives have delta functions. And you have to understand what those delta function densities are. And basically, to make the long story short, the delta functions are in the theta, theta, and phi, phi components of the stress tensor only. So it corresponds to surface tensions, just like on a bubble. It's like on a thin film bubble wall, but there's no mass there.
But that's a key difference. There's no mass.
There's no mass, so it's different, so like all the...
every energy condition, right? There's no energy density, and you have non-zero pressure on these infinitesimally thin boundaries.
Yes. Yes.
Doesn't now, that bother you? I mean, that sounds very unphysical.
I don't know. It's a... And you can understand easily just from the continuity equation that how does it go? P plus rho. Basically, this equation is derived under the assumption that the energy momentum tensor has the form of a perfect fluid with all principal pressures equal. If I let these guys, spherical symmetry demands that these two have to be equal. If I let them be different than this, then there's additional term here, which I, from memory, I think is this. So it vanishes if p theta is equal to p. But the way to think about these surface tensions is just that this is basically not doing anything violent there. It has a theta function, but no delta function. But this thing is it has a delta function discontinuity. So dp is finite as dr goes to zero. So if I smooth that out a little bit more, then the way to think about it is that that delta function is being absorbed by this p theta. So you have
on the inside you've got this Bose tendency,
yeah.
Right, which is these exotic properties. But now in the middle we've got stuff that doesn't seem as marked.
Well, you can't have mass there if you want a static solution. If you put mass there, then then the surface is going to move.
Is it another kind of gravitational condensate?
No, I'm trying to explain. It's nothing more than this this pressure gradient changing, this pressure gradient growing large there. So if you just had
this can't happen in ordinary. You can't make this happen in ordinary matter. You can't get an interface between two gases where there's TRR and where there's T theta theta and no T zero zero.
In ordinary gases, no. You have isotropic.
Well, or in any kind of matter. I mean, you're postulating solution, working backwards and finding areas of stress. But
that's right.
I mean, stress is a property of some material, and can there be any physical system that has these properties?
Joe's saying it's not like a soap bubble, for example.
Yeah, but okay, the energy density in the soap bubble is not very large, right? MC squared, yeah, of course. The rest mass energy is very large. But yeah. No, that's true.
Yeah. And if you smoothed it out,
if I smooth it out, then this derivative would be large but finite, and p theta would be large but finite. But it would be deviating largely from the other p.
But in that smoothed out transition region,
yeah,
the energy density would probably still be smaller than the pressure.
Yes. P this p and this rho remain finite, and this p theta grows very large. That's the only way to make it static. I agree.
guess the point is that many of us feel that's much more exotic than your condensate in the middle.
Well, okay.
Because it violates all...
I mean, I violated all the other energy conditions, so I don't know why this one should bother. I mean, the strong energy condition has been violated, right?
Yeah, but that one was always the weakest, though. I mean, yeah.
You're worried about the dominant or the...
Or even
the weak energy condition, yes. Yeah. Okay, but this is what we did. So I don't know. Absolutely what you said, right, Joe. I mean, we did it by going backwards and finding what stress would have to require it to be static. But I think, okay, I shouldn't say more here. Let's go on. Get to the end. Okay, so once you have all of these solutions and the matchings, then you can, of course, calculate anything you like. So you can look at the proper thickness of the shell, and there is a small parameter epsilon. Basically, the matching, I didn't write, it's in the paper, but the matchings are all done with this parameter epsilon taken to be very small. And now you can estimate how small is small by looking at the thickness of this shell. It's just some finite integral over W. W is remaining finite inside this wall. And so this becomes epsilon to the 3/2, because dW is other epsilon by the matching conditions. And so you can just sit, in physical terms, epsilon is of order this proper thickness divided by the Schwarzschild radius, the mass, to the 2/3 power. So if L is independent of M, as I say, the Einstein theory doesn't know anything about what R1 and R2 are, what L should be. So I have to, it's just a free parameter of my solution. If I demand that L is independent of M, because I have in mind there's some microscopic physics going on there, which I'm only mocking up in the Einstein theory by some equation of state, then this thing could be some fixed multiple of the Planck scale. It could be a million times the Planck scale, but it's not going to scale with M. That's all that's important. And so this is a very small number if M is large.
Abel?
Yeah.
Suppose that you let R1 go to R2 and get rid of region 2, and then you have a discontinuity in H as in your diagram.
Yes.
There.
Yes, a cusp.
A cusp in H.
Yeah, right.
And you could ask the same question. If I invert that and ask what kind of matter caused that, what would the answer be?
That's I think you'd be even unhappier, because I mean, technically, people try to match Schwarzschild to De Sitter several different ways, many different times. And the problem is, if you try to do it right on the horizon, then you really do generate a shockwave discontinuity, real matter, right on the light cone. As far as I can tell, the limit of the Israel junction conditions for this case, which R1 and R2 are first held away from each other, and you have everything done at a fixed time surface, that limit, when you then take R1 to R2, is singular, and it's not the same as doing things on the light cone in the first place.
Question.
Yeah.
If I understood rightly, the state inside is basically some condensate. Of,
yes.
So what sense do all these things make? I mean, because, I mean, if you have different degrees of freedom, you don't have any more general relativity, so why, how can, I mean...
Different degrees of freedom?
I mean, when you condensate the gravitons, mm-hmm. we have different, it's like in the post, I mean, you have a different...
There are different excitations inside the De Sitter phase on the outside, yes. So?
That's sort of a question.
So that's a classical question.
Maybe I didn't understand, but...
May I ask a question? Sorry.
Yes, sure.
To follow up on Krishna's question, is there anything that forces you to take the cusp at where the functions actually go to zero? Can't you join them earlier?
Well, only at the price of introducing in a horizon. You mean move it here, and then I'd be outside. I'm not sure I understand. You want to go?
No, change the parameter such that those two functions, the one from the inside, ends at a higher radius, larger radius than the one that's coming from the outside. So they sort of cross like this.
Yeah, that's.
And then they cross before, there seems to be no horizon where they cross. It seems to be a perfectly irregular.
That limit, as I was answering, that limit will generate energy momentum, additional singularities.
But he actually went one step farther than I did. So suppose there's no horizon. So just change the integration constant of the interior solution.
Yeah.
Such that those two curves, if you did no smoothing, those two curves would cross pretty far to the right, where H is still quite non-zero.
So what do you want to do? You want to do this?
Yes. Yeah. Exactly.
And okay.
And then ask what kind of matter you would have at that point. There's no horizon anywhere now.
Yeah. You can do that. I haven't.
Well, I'm not sure what.
It's a doable problem. I mean, it's an exercise.
I'm not sure what he was thinking, but I guess from the sense of my question is, I'm trying to understand what the rules are. In the sense that the rules seem to be, you invert Einstein's equations and see what energy tensor momentum tensor you get.
No. No, we had energy momentum tensor in the interior region and the shell, and both of those were. I tried to give a reason for that.
You
now,
didn't notice a meeting about Mark who moved my office into the basement.
Okay. Okay. That's fine. Okay. Where were we? Each of those separate equation of states in the interior region, I tried to give a motivation for. The matching requires, as we've all been discussing, something to happen at those interfaces. Okay. Now, whether you want to call that a new form of matter or just the switching from one form to the other, I mean, we can debate how exotic or wild it is, but that's. The rules were not to, you know, to write something, some metric down, and then that wasn't what we did. So just to be clear, all right.
Can you treat the smooth equation of state equation properly?
Sure, you can. Sure, you can.
Then you wouldn't probably have any singularities. Then.
No, you won't have any singularities. That's what I'm saying. If you had this, if you did something like in superfluidity, right, the Landau two fluid model, then you think of this p equals rho as the normal fluid, and you think of the interior as the superfluid, the condensate, and then there's some boundary layer where the two fluids intermix.
But that has p equals infinity times rho in the layer. It doesn't interpolate. It's a different stuff.
This dpdr is finite, then it has a p theta.
Yeah, right. So in the layer, p is infinity. P, rho is zero, and p is not. So yeah, this funny equation of state, p is infinity times rho.
Large, yes. If you smooth it,
smooth it is large.
Yeah.
Much larger than one.
Yeah, in the angular directions, which is all that you can demand, I think, from spherical symmetry. But we've understood the situation. Okay, so I don't.
I think it's the glaring point in the situation that should be mentioned. I mean, if you express it as an equation of state,
yes,
you sort of postulate an equation or derive an equation of state, p equals a large number times rho, which is not something you would have wanted from the start.
Fine. Not something I thought of from the start. For you. Okay, so now I just want to just tell you what the features of this star and then go to the conclusion. So the interesting thing is, although the energy is essentially all in the interior, because you have this energy density, which is of course matched to the mass, so the energy density is always 1 over m squared inside the interior. So basically all of the energy measured at asymptotic distances is in the interior. There's very little in the shell. It's of order epsilon squared, very small. However, as we said in this condensate phase, there's no entropy. So all the entropy resides in the shell. So you can just do the calculation and integrate up the entropy density coming from this equation of state, which implies a T squared temperature dependence. So just simple thermodynamic relations, integrate up the entropy, and you find the entropy is some number, which in principle you can calculate just by doing this integral. And it's some number multiplied by m, so it's linear in m, and the thickness of the shell. It's not surprising the thickness of the shell enters because all the entropy is coming from the shell. So numerically, of course, this is vastly much smaller than the Bekenstein-Hawking formula. So instead of 10 to the 77, it is going to be linear in m. And if L is the Planck length, that's the most extreme you could make it, then it's 10 to the 38. If it's a million times the Planck length, then it's a million times bigger than this. But it's very much smaller than Hawking, and smaller still, very much smaller than a normal hot radiating object like the sun.
Is there anything happening when L becomes very large, like GM?
Well, our particular solution will break down because I assumed H was small. And in terms of the question that was being asked before, if H doesn't get small, then I can't do my analytic solution. You'd have to solve the equations numerically, for one thing. But that's not a point of principle, to be sure.
The point is, and then this entropy becomes of the same order.
Then they become the same order, yes. And in fact, that's a limit in which you get something close to what the TIF solution is like. If you extend the P equals rho solution all the way down to the interior, all the way down to the origin, then you will indeed get an entropy of order Bekenstein-Hawking. The numerical factor has to be computed by solving equations, but it will indeed be of order m squared, and the price will be that you'll push your singularity to the origin again. So you may not like the energy density, but it's better than the singularity.
Isn't it worse to form something with lower entropy than something with larger entropy?
Worse than what? That's what happens when you blow off entropy in a supernova, for example. You cool an object down, you lose entropy. The last thing we did, and the reason why I do think this could be considered an alternative scenario, that's all I'm saying at the moment, is that we studied the stability of this thing. Of course, if it were just to collapse back to a black hole, I would be wasting your time and mine. So what we did was look at the entropy functional and study the fluctuations. Of course, I've done a hydrodynamic theory, so I have some equation of state, so I can look at fluctuations of the fluid within that hydrodynamic framework. I haven't given you a microscopic description of these degrees of freedom, so that's the only thing I can do within a hydrodynamic framework. And there's some facts that would take me a little time to go through, but basically, there's an interesting point which is known for about 35 years, that if you write the entropy functional with some equation of state here, and you basically can eliminate all the degrees of freedom except one function, which you can think of as m of r, the run of the mass function with radius, and then if you extremize the entropy functional with respect to this one function, it turns out that the extremum of the entropy is identical to the Tolman, Oppenheimer, Volkoff equations, in other words, the Einstein equations for static equilibrium. So this is an interesting fact all by itself, that the Einstein theory is equivalent to a hydrodynamic minimization of the entropy functional. Dynamics is hydrodynamics for a perfect fluid in static equilibrium. Now, the next thing you can do is look at the second variations of this entropy functional, and that's what we did. So the analysis is pretty straightforward. Basically, you should think of this as a microcanonical analysis, the entropy, the extremization of the entropy at fixed energy.
I'm sorry, Emil, you're assuming spherical symmetry here as well as static? When you say Einstein's equation is equivalent.
Yeah, in spherically symmetric, the MDR.
Okay, yeah. So for spherically symmetric static configurations.
Right, this was proven by a gentleman named Koch about 1965. So there's nothing much to do in the two vacuum regions. And outside Schwarzschild, you can go look at Chandrasekhar's book, and all of the stability is well studied there. and it's almost as well studied, equally straightforward to do in De Sitter space, as long as you stay away from the horizons, that the only tricky business can come at the horizon. And since we have no horizon here, it's basically straightforward to look at the stability in those regions. So the only non-trivial region, again, is this shell region. And here everything is written in terms of this metric, this mass function 2gm, which is mu. And so for this equation of state, the entropy takes that form. And its second variation, of course, produces a quadratic form in the fluctuations of this mass function. Again, the first variation gives you the equation which we've already solved for the static spherically symmetric solution. And the second variation is just giving you some associated Sturm-Liouville differential operator, which by a change of variables, the important point to notice is that there are zero modes of this operator, which have to do with moving the surfaces, moving R1 and R2. If you plug that in, then you can explicitly see that the entropy functional, the second variation, is negative definite.
So it's stable against moving R1 and R2?
No. These are fixed.
Those are zero modes?
Those are zero modes. So from the point of view of the Einstein theory, these are, if you wish, collective coordinates or zero modes. It doesn't know and doesn't care where you put R1 and R2.
But doesn't the entropy increase when you increase?
Increases linearly, sure.
Wouldn't this object just want to start keep pushing that region bigger and bigger?
Well, no, unless, I mean, this is a question of the phase transition dynamics, right? I mean, it's a question of which is the local, you can't use this entropy principle to decide where R1 and R2 are. That's all that tells you. That you have to have some other theory.
How do you decide?
It's a free parameter.
How does the star decide?
Yeah. The star has to decide by knowing what the microscopic theory is. Okay. So there's, in a Bose-Einstein condensate, there's something called a healing length, and that has to be calculated from a microscopic many-body theory. Of course, the condensate knows what that length is. So this is the analog of that, but I have only given you a macroscopic description, so it's a free parameter at this level.
Would there be something like surface tension which would eventually decide?
This, it could.
Surface tension between two different phases.
It could. It could. As you know, this is only the beginning. Okay. So let me just summarize, and then we can talk about anything. You can criticize anything more you want. This is what we did. Here are the main features of this solution. So it's vacuum Schwarzschild exterior. So from the outside, it looks, feels, quacks like a black hole, right? It will have the same kind of orbits and accretion disk and so on. In the inside, however, it has this condensate De Sitter solution with no singularity. It has this thin shell where they're joined between each other, but no event horizon. So there is a global time. So this has no problem at all with quantum mechanics or unitarity. And of course, there's no Hawking radiation because there's no horizon here. So the entire analysis of the Hawking flux would be quite different. In fact, this is a static solution, so you could just construct quantum modes on this static background, and there's no need to have any kind of flux at all. There's vacuum polarization, but not any flux. The entropy is modest. It could be very much smaller than that of the progenitor star. So there's no information paradox. It's stable. I didn't mention during the matching, but everything is basically at these shells. Everything going on there, the delta functions even, everything is of order 1 over m squared. So if the mass is very large, nothing Planckian happens, particularly to the energy densities anywhere. So for example, in the TUF solution, he did have, if you extend this p equals rho region all the way to the center, you do get Planckian densities. Here, nothing is Planckian. You can think of this as something like a shock front, a stationary shock front, and that there are, again, various condensed matter analogies which could be invoked here to think about this interface region. And of course, the interior is also a cosmological space-time. So if you really want to indulge yourself, you can think of the cosmology is embedded inside one of these objects. The whole universe with, of course, a much different value of the cosmological term. So I think it's an interesting possibility that the postulate, of course, is that there is a quantum phase transition, which in the vicinity of the black hole or cosmological event horizon can provide some solution to all of these problems with black hole physics. And by the way, of course, it screens the cosmological constant on the outside, right? So it's kind of confined. Now, the last thing, which I'll just end on, is things have to be eventually subjected to some kind of test. And if you are serious about thinking about objects like this, whatever they are, it may not be exactly this model, but whatever alternative you want, then you have to think about what the astrophysical signatures might be. So obviously, this object would look a lot like a black hole. And so the kinds of candidates that people are looking at would not be able to distinguish in most ways, because it's still cold, dark, and compact. With arbitrary mass, it would accrete just like a black hole. The main difference, of course, only occurs when I reach the would-be horizon, where classically I just disappeared down this event horizon, down this hole. But here I would hit some kind of fairly dense shell. Even though it goes like 1 over m squared and therefore is not Planckian, for normal masses, that's still a pretty hefty density. It could be nuclear-like density. So you're definitely going to hit something and know it if this object is encountered. You could, of course, re-emit energy from, once you strike this thing, it can start vibrating. It can shoot energy back out at you. It's a possibly much more efficient engine for high energy astrophysical sources, because you don't have to rely completely on the accretion disk to get stuff out. You can get it out from the shell itself. The Bose-Einstein people have already coined this word, bosonova, for a collapsing Bose-Einstein condensate, but that's so they already, it's not my fault, they already stole that word, but that's the kind of word that would be appropriate if one of these things formed out of stellar collapse. They didn't even realize, of course, that could be talking about an astrophysical object. It's a very interesting question of whether this kind of solution can support angular momentum and magnetic fields. Certainly it can. For small angular momentum, you can perturb and look at small values of angular momentum. But nothing like the Kerr solution has been done yet for arbitrary values of angular momentum. It would be a very interesting problem, I think, to see. I would expect to have, basically based on the superfluid analogy, to have some mean density of flux lines penetrating through the desiter or condensate phase. And so you could support angular momentum and probably magnetic fields that way, which is another way to think differently than black holes, which it's quite hard to have magnetic fields inside. So you can think of signatures like gravitational waves, but that's pretty far away yet. And we're just starting to think about if there are real ways to distinguish this from black hole. So I think I'll end right there. Thank you. Now you can attack at will.
What happens to matter that falls into this star? Stay on the shell?
Well, it goes through the phase transition. If you do it adiabatically, presumably just drop things very slowly onto this thing. You're just accreting matter onto it. So you move on this family of solutions from one mass to another. If you do it non-adiabatically, then I don't know, without solving some complicated time-dependent equations, but I presume you'll start the thing, it has normal modes, so it'll start to shake and it could shoot some of the stuff back out at you. But that's a much, I don't know. It's a dynamical question. Of course, it's just a static solution.
Can I rephrase the question which I asked before?
Sure.
Normally, when I think about the condensate, I think, for example, of the gas becoming a fluid. The gas is described by some equation, by the Boltzmann equation. The fluid is described by different equations. The degrees of freedom are changed when you have a condensation from one place to the other.
Yes.
Then how can you use GR? I mean, GR is the effective theory for weakly coupled things outside this thing. But then inside, you say you have the sitter and you have space-time at all. Mm-hmm. You shouldn't be using GR to describe the inside, because GR is not anymore the theory. I mean, the theory which describes. I mean, you had the condensation. I mean, you had a phase transition. You have different degrees of freedom. There's a different thing.
There's a latent heat. The latent heat between the two phases is the cosmological term. So there's no reason why the two phases can't be described within a hydrodynamic framework. Of course, right at the edge, you can question that. I agree. You can ask whether any of these features we're worried about right on this interfaces, surely that does require a microscopic description beyond GR to really have
you also have the phase inside not to be described by GR. I mean, in your model, you chose the phase inside to be described by GR, but you could have a condensation, and the resulting state could not be just GR.
You can do whatever you like, but I tried to motivate that a condensate should have this equation of state, and I believe there should be a local principle of equivalence just as well inside as out. So this is, if you wish, the minimal disturbance on GR that you can have. Is to have a phase transition in which all the effects are localized in some boundary layer, but everywhere else, GR is just fine. Now, you want to do something else? You can't. Fair enough.
This might be a little strange, but could you kind of reverse the situation? Our world not outside, but inside.
Yeah.
And the cosmological constant.
Well, oh, that's what I said. It's a cosmological solution.
But of course,
it's not a realistic cosmological solution because it's empty de Sitter space. So you'd have to generate some kind of time-dependent solution in which that's varying with time. Put matter in and try to match to a Robertson-Walker universe inside. Haven't done it. That idea was around a long time too. I mean, I think it was Sakharov who suggested that basically. Before inflation, that if you had a cosmological term, you could eliminate initial singularities and put it inside of a black hole.
You mentioned on one of the last slides that we even have hyperfermentation in the sense of the semi-classical on gravity. But presumably, this thing's got a temperature.
Well, there's a local, I didn't mention that, I went past that quickly. The local temperature inside the shell is non-zero, but extremely small. In fact, the local temperature is just by dimensions of order of what you would think of the Hawking temperature. It's 1 over m. But that, any radiation that would come off of that thing is redshifted by some huge factor, this 1 over epsilon. Hence, the temperature is observed at infinity is some absurdly small value, like 10 to the minus 25 Kelvin. So it doesn't radiate, really.
Any more questions?
Thanks.